This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Junkions and into another magical episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is your weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as per usual, is my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he's a lieutenant of Megaforce, he is one of the cronies from Streets of Fire who just wants to kiss women hard.
And I'm also going to be played by four different actors in this episode.
And through the course of this episode,
we will both
be played by four different actors.
I wish I could have just, like, you know, called up, like, a couple of actors we know and have them come and hang out. And then at different parts of the podcast just take over for me.
That would require planning, which we don't do a lot of.
We really don't do a lot of planning.
Taking the cork out of the bottle is about the amount of planning we usually do.
That is correct, sir.
But yes, Cargill, hello. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Fantastic. And if you would like to hear more of us, our sadly unprepared podcast, you can check the back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. If you go to iTunes, please rate and review us there. That really does help us move up the ranks and get more listeners, and we really do appreciate that. If you really like the show, not only can you check out the back catalog, not only can you follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema.
What else can they do?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Cargill. You can become a patron. Go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And what you do is you kick in a few shekels per episode. And no matter what the rate that you give to us, what we're going to do for you is we're going to do a bunch of bonus episodes
that only
our patrons in the inner sanctum get to hear. And I must announce, I'm very excited to announce as of tonight, we are at $319 per episode, eclipsing our $300 per episode goal, meaning that the taste test is a go. And if you're forgetting what this is the special added bonus feature where you patrons can actually send me movies that I have to watch and record mini reviews for. And the inbox is already filling up with stuff, some of which I was like, yeah, I've seen that. And some of which I'm like, I'm terrified to watch that. So the Rochambeau of cinema is happening, the taste test.
I'm waiting for somebody to send you the Sharknado box set.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Or doing what I did to a buddy of mine where I had a buddy who had something like that going on, and I sent him the Look Who's Talking box set.
Oof.
With Look Who's Talking, Look Who's Talking To, and Look Oof. Who's Talking Now. Yeah, that was not a fun phone call.
You know what you can do also is the movie geek equivalent of icing somebody, which is when they're not looking, you just sit a copy of Ice Pirates in front of them, and then they have to watch it.
Oh, no.
Sucker, and you walk away.
Oh, I want that to hold up so bad, and it just doesn't.
It just does not.
It just doesn't.
Unfortunately.
It makes me so sad.
It does not.
Space herpes is not funny when you're 40 years old.
Hey, speaking of things that make people sad, today's movie, continuing on the theme of Mr. Doctor.
Mr. Doctor.
We have arrived at, I believe, the third Terry Gilliam film that we have covered.
I thought it was only the second. What's the...
Time Bandits.
We
covered
Time
Bandits.
We did cover
Time
Bandits.
So this is the third.
Oh, yes.
This
is
the third Terry Gilliam.
We are eventually going to get through all but one or two of the Gilliams.
This is the Gilliam hat trick, which is appropriate since so many of his characters wear funny hats. And in this movie, plenty of funny hats to go around. It's the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
That's right.
1,000 years ago... Dr. Parnassus made a deal with the devil.
Stop!
You're probably not a betting man, are you?
To gain immortality.
It's been a while.
But this came with a price.
Any child would at the age of 16 belong to him.
Now, a mysterious outsider.
Can you put a price on your dreams?
We'll take the traveling show beyond their imaginations.
The extraordinary Dr. Parnassus.
What are you doing?
Trying to save your daughter's life, sir!
You can save her. What do you say? First to five souls.
Voila.
The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
We get the we get one of his more oddball and fun and strange films that also has a very weird story to it.
It seems like a lot of Gilliam films have interesting, if not troubled, production stories.
You think?
It's almost like the guy is cursed, because, I mean, you hear all the time about his failed attempts, his failed multiple attempts to get the Man of La Mancha off the ground.
Right.
You hear about all the things that he struggled with things I think we talked about a little bit on 12 Monkeys. And on this film, he had the unfortunate bad luck of...
The worst of all possible things.
The worst thing that could possibly happen to a production is that your lead actor, your main character...
Your big name star...
passes away before all of his footage is shot. Heath Ledger in this movie plays not the title role, but a pivotal role. The character by which the audience takes its journey, your monomyth hero, if you will, passes away before all his footage is shot. And if it were any other director, I feel, if it were any other film, they would have just scrapped it because they didn't have but maybe a quarter of his footage done, half at most. So, I mean, you're really looking at a situation where, in most cases, that would be it. End of story. But
movie's over.
This is a fantasy film, which, if you are familiar with Terry Gilliam, should not surprise you. The plot of which basically revolves around a strange mystic figure by the name of Dr. Parnassus, who travels with a... It's sort of a carnival, not a sideshow, but a carnival production... that delves into Eastern mysticism, delves into fairy tales. I mean, it's
almost like they're a group of troubadours.
Yes. Yeah, and very much so.
It is an oddball set of troubadours giving a very weird mystical journey for people.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a very strange kind of mystical journey. And as the movie unfolds and unravels, it all kind of comes together and you put it together. But like many of Gilliam's films, there is much more hidden in the code than you get out of your primary viewing.
Yeah.
And you have to decode the movie. And once you do, it means something very, very different than you necessarily thought initially.
And of course, the allegorical element comes to light, you know, just a few minutes in, and you really start to understand who these characters represent, who they are the antecedents for, and why the character of Tony is so vital to the story. And, you know, he's the one that goes through the magic mirror and is sort of the catalyst for the feud between our hero and our villain, and, you know, our larger than life representations of the big hero and the big villain with capital letters.
Yes. So. No, and that's what's interesting about this movie is structurally it's kind of a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Which may or may not have to do entirely with Heath Ledger's death.
Yeah.
However,
Heath Ledger, who was originally cast as Tony.
Yeah, Heath Ledger is Tony. Heath Ledger passed away after having shot some of it. And as we'll talk about, they brilliantly recast with several other actors to play him in separate parts of this movie. But he, like you mentioned, that he's kind of our monomyth hero, and he's on a journey, but he's actually, what we learn over the course of the movie, a villain. He's an antagonist. But we have two, and I love that you said it, you know, capital letter villain and hero, because we have a protagonist and an antagonist that are the big overarching protagonist and antagonist, and then we have these minor antagonists and protagonists, and the protagonist is actually not Tony.
Yeah,
it's Andrew Garfield in one of his first roles, in like the first role that people recognize.
Who is phenomenal in this.
Oh God, as everyone is. But yes, Andrew Garfield was this young kid, and he's like, oh yes, he's the entertaining brooding young kid next to Heath Ledger in this. Not when we first watched this, nobody realized this movie was actually Heath Ledger passing the torch to Andrew Garfield, who would then go on to become a light of other films. In fact, when I rewatched this on the night that I went and saw Hacksaw Ridge, not, you know, totally forgetting that Andrew Garfield was in Parnassus. And the minute it comes on, I was like, holy shit, I'm literally going to spend 5 hours with Andrew Garfield going through crazy shit tonight. Like, that's, this is my day. All right. But yes, he is phenomenally good and is playing this very interesting, you know, what is essentially our B story protagonist. Like, he's the guy we're really kind of rooting for. He's the guy that gets the big reward, because as we come to find out, our big, huge characters, our big capital letter villain and big capital letter hero, are actually forces of nature and are not characters.
Yeah.
And that's what I find so fucking fascinating about this movie. Like, structurally, it's just weird and it's very hard to wrap your mind around in a way that good Gilliam does.
Yeah.
On first viewing. But it is a wonderful film. It's a film that makes me happy. It's a film that deals with the type of things that we don't really get to see. It's almost like a Neil Gaiman story, like in terms of what it's dealing with. And I find it beautiful, and I find it deep, and I find it moving, and just fucking bonkers fucking cool.
Well, and that's the Gilliam coming out for sure. And of course, we're going to end up talking about the visuals of this movie. But as far as...
For
better and for worse. The character of Tony, as it turns out, is something of a con artist. He's something of a flim-flammer. And what they...
A Skazmopsy Skazimer.
A Hornswoggler. And other candies you can buy in British candy stores in the movie Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Can you actually buy a Hornswoggler?
I think you can. Willy Wonka? I'm pretty sure you can. Or maybe that's a creature that feeds on Oompa Loompas. I don't know. The whole movie's very trippy. As is this, in fact. But that character, because he is a character who is using manipulative means to get what he wants, and because he's a character that Parnassus recognizes this in, it then became a natural sort of story element to have this character portrayed by multiple actors, because it's a character who will put on, you know, quote unquote, different faces to get what he wants. So it's one of those things that any other, that's what I'm saying. Any other film, if your lead, your big name star and one of your very important lead characters of the story passes away before half their footage is shot, you either got to recast and reshoot everything, or that production's getting the plug pulled. But with this type of story, it actually makes sense that this character is then played by Jude Law, Johnny Depp, Colin Farrell, all playing the same character in the mirror. In this, you know, once you go through the mirror and you're in the Imaginarium, you can kind of be portrayed however, you know, your mind perceives it, and it just works. And it works in a way that, what's beautiful about this film is that not a single performance of anyone else playing Tony takes away from Ledger. It feels like everyone honoring him. You can feel that in the marrow of this movie.
Well, they were all friends of his, and they were all brokenhearted, and the fact that they could play him and play their friend and play their friend's character was great. And it's fun, and they all have a really good time doing it.
And they all only agreed to do it if they could donate their salary to Heath Ledger's daughter to secure, which is such a sweet story.
And just to cap that off, when the movie ends, it gives a film by credit that you've never seen before. Like, and I don't think is actually a legal film by credit. So I think it's like just a little, it's this little thing that says a film by Heath Ledger and friends. And it's the one of those adorable, heartbreaking, oh, fuck, this is it. This is his last, like, you know, The Dark Knight is his last complete film, and this is his last film.
And there's something eerily prescient about the fact that this character begins this movie dead, essentially.
Oh, it's this great thing. You know, you've got Dr. Parnassus, who is some weird mystical man, and we'll get into that in a moment, who, you know, while doing the tarot, gets the card of the Hanged Man. And sure enough, they actually literally encounter a man dangling from underneath the bridge that they're camped out on. And he was left there to die. And the rest of the story becomes, how did that guy get there? Why was he there? And can we trust him? And of course, you cannot. As the movie goes on, you find out this guy is a piece of shit.
Yeah.
This guy is a guy who literally was using a children's charity that he started to launder money.
Yeah.
And figured out a way to kind of fake his own death. And in doing so, he's now traveling around kind of hiding out and waiting for the big storm to blow over for his disgraced charity, but then discovers the magic of Parnassus's mirror, because Parnassus, when he focuses and you step through this mirror, that's not really a mirror. You step into his imagination, and Parnassus doesn't really have an imagination. He has your imagination. And so he creates a world that you want to see. And as we find out through a bit of dialogue in the film, he's not really a mystic man as he's being portrayed. He is something entirely. He is a force of nature, which leads to his antithesis, which this is something I wanted to mention right away, because look, I don't care if you like this movie or not. Like, there's a bunch of people who are like, yeah, this movie's a disappointment. You cannot call any movie a fucking disappointment that has Tom Waits as the devil.
One of the most singularly inspired pieces of casting I have ever seen.
Tom Waits as the devil is amazing and has a beautiful little through line to it, which is, those of you may know, there is this great video online and you can look it up. It is Tom Waits in 1977 doing an interview on an Australian television show. Now, some of you are like, why the fuck do you know about this stupid interview from 1997?
One very good reason.
On a television show. When you watch Tom Waits and the way he speaks and the way he acts on this show, you realize that was Heath Ledger's inspiration for playing the Joker.
Fully. Full. It is eerie to watch.
They tell me that you have sort of a cult following. Is that what you don't, do you agree with that expression, a cult following?
I have a growing level of popularity throughout the intercontinental United States, Japan, and I travel extensively in Europe as well. I don't do half bad.
Heath Ledger's Joker, his final completed film, is him riffing on Tom Waits before he then goes and makes a movie with Tom Waits in which Tom Waits plays the devil trying to kill him.
Yeah.
Like, let that sink in for a second.
Oof. You got goosebumps yet? Because you should.
Because that's legit. So now we've got Tom Waits playing the devil, and Tom Waits' devil is so fucking great.
Yes.
Like, the devil, like, so I love representations of the devil. I love it in film. I from the goofy ones in like the Oh God, You Devils.
Sure.
The Oh God and that, the George Burns stuff, to I'm a big fan of Needful Things. Mm-hmm. And Max von Sydow's representation of the devil.
I think to paraphrase a line from Fight Club, on a long enough timeline, every actor plays the devil.
Every good one, yeah.
Every good actor plays the devil.
So this, however, stands as one of the most fun, because this devil isn't an evil, rotten, shitty bastard. Like, he's not an awful human being or an awful entity. He actually is going after real shit heels.
Yeah.
Like, he's really...
He's the Dexter of devils.
He is. Like, everybody he gets in this movie has it fucking coming. Like, really bad. And, like, there's people that he kind of gets, like, over the course... Like, there's this one character that he gets, this woman who kind of gets thrown in there and ends up hanging out with him and ends up as his girlfriend for a while. And he's like, oh, she doesn't count. I'm not taking her soul. Like, he's just like, no, we're just hanging out and screwing. Like, that's just this thing that we're like, no, I didn't claim her soul. But, you know, the gangsters who were funneling money through a children's fund? Oh, yeah, those guys totally fucking get it. Those guys are going down. But here's what's interesting is this entire movie, the driving force of it is that Parnassus made a bet with the devil, and that bet he lost. Mm-hmm. And he's been supposedly making bets all throughout history because he cannot stop betting and he can't stop gambling. And the cover story, the story that this movie has to offer, is that he's a guy that won immortality from the devil and has been living indefinitely through life. And the devil keeps making bets with him and he keeps losing. And the last bet he made was the devil would give him, make him young again, give him mortality back temporarily, but that... so that he could fall in love with this woman and seduce her and then marry her. But if that happened, any child that would be the product of that love, the devil would get on her 16th birthday.
Which is very Grimm's Brothers. Like, very much like your firstborn. Be careful what you wish for and taking the firstborn. And that's very much a Grimm's Brothers caveat.
Yeah. And so... So that seems so that is the essence of what seems to be driving the narrative. But that's not really what's fucking going on here. Like, that's not actually the story. That's all a lie. Mm-hmm. It's the devil's lie. And Parnassus just isn't really in touch with who he is. And he's forgotten who he is. And he's essentially, whether he's the actual brother of the devil or whether they're just two forces, Parnassus isn't actually a human being. He is a force like the devil. He is, as he actually says, here's the brilliance of this screenplay. There are three moments in the film where a character will utter three things trying to get the answer right. But every answer is true. And the one that Parnassus says at the end, Parnassus is drunk and you think he's stuttering through being drunk, but it's actually the most honest Parnassus is through the entire movie. And he says, I am Felicity. I am Felicius. I am the facilitator. And what he thinks he's saying is that he's setting up how people get into this world. But as far as we can see from the movie, Parnassus's imagination is the only way the devil can actually tempt people into hell. And that Parnassus is Felicity. He's happiness. He's this moment of pure, sudden inspiration and joy in a moment that can drive someone to a revelation. That's who he is. And the devil, when you are offered that moment of inspiration, the devil also can tempt you away to see what you're really made of. And the devil, every time he loses, is just kind of like, ah, shucks, see, I totally didn't get that one. You got me at that time, Parnassus. Because this is how the devil operates. The devil needs the people to actually sin and be shitty human beings in order to claim their souls. And so the devil uses these bets with Parnassus to convince Parnassus to go after these souls. And so that's really what is driving the overarching narrative. The understory is the one where all the real soul is, which you have Andrew Garfield, who's this young man that's fallen in love with Parnassus' daughter. And everybody knows he's in love with her, except for her. And she is infatuated with this guy she sees in a magazine. Like, she's daydreaming of this roguish, handsome guy, which is actually a badly photoshopped Colin Farrell. And she, you know, is seeing this. And when Tony shows up, Tony looks suspiciously like this dreamboat of hers. And so she starts falling for him and falling for all the lies.
Right.
And so what's happening is the overarching, like, the big capital letter story is about Parnassus fighting for the soul of his daughter, and the understory is about the soul of this daughter. Is she going to choose the pure love the happiness, the Parnassus, the felicity, or is she going to choose the shitheel, the devil, the guy so bad the devil wants to get him and the devil wants to fuck him over? Like, that's the thing. Like, that's the moment where I really fall in love with this movie, is the moment when the devil comes up to Parnassus and Parnassus is like, I lost. And he's like, get over it, kid. No big deal. It's not a big thing. But look, I'll make you a deal. Help me get this guy. I've been trying to get him for years. Figure out what his deal is. Figure out whatever this black magic is that's keeping me from being able to kill him, and get him, get me his soul.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Parnassus goes and then pulls his big chicanery. And in true fashion, he is Felicitous. He does, in fact, through a moment of pure inspiration, just do exactly what he needs to do to fool this guy and trick this guy into killing himself and condemning himself to hell.
Which is a very devilish move for a character who is supposed to be the antithesis of the devil.
Because he's not actually the antithesis of the devil. They are one and the same. It is almost like they're the same character. And, you know, he's immortal, but he doesn't experience time in the same way we do. Like, he goes into his imagination and he's there and he comes back out and he's been homeless for years. Like, you know, it's for him, it was an instant. And then we look through a window and we see the end of the movie and we see who won and we see, you know, the real reward. And that is, you know, he's missed that for years, and he's literally looking at his family. You know, Andrew Garfield has ended up with Valentina and they have a child, an adorable little redheaded kid, as you'd expect to pop out of this adorable couple. And he's looking at his family, but he doesn't want to ruin the moment. And he doesn't want to ruin any of this for them because he left on very bad terms. So he's going to let them have their happiness, because at the end of the day, he is that happiness. Like, he has brought about this happiness. This happiness happened because of him.
He is Felicity.
He is Felicity. And so he then ends up, as great stories do, just like at the end of Casablanca, he gets to walk off with his version of Claude Rains, Vern Troyer. And they get their great joke, because they have this great running joke where, you know, Parnassus is always like, what would I do without you? And Vern Troyer always goes, get a midget. And like the first time he says it, he's like, what? He's like, you know, midget, a little taller than me, kind of bigger head. Like, it starts like, it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
And at the same time, that's also a joke about Terry Gilliam himself, because a Terry Gilliam movie...
He'd get a time bandit.
Well, it's hard to find Terry Gilliam movies that don't have, you know, little people in
That's
them.
True.
Like, it's literally like he, you know, he gets to even, he even squeezed one in
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Yes. Like, where he even squeezes one in where it's like telephone call for you. Like, it's just, this is a Terry Gilliam joke. Like, what would I do without you, Vern Troyer? You'd get a midget. Like, yeah, of course you would, Terry Gilliam. But so that's, and I feel like Parnassus and Parnassus's imagination, this is Terry Gilliam's most honest, revelatory movie. This is him talking about himself and dealing with his struggles with his imagination and trying to come up with new ideas and continuing to try to make movies in an era where people are moving away from the type of stories that he wants to tell.
So it becomes prescient and appropriate that he's having these issues with his lead act, and by issues I mean the death of his lead actor, because in a movie that is so much about him and reflecting upon himself as an artist and his career, that kind of struggle behind the scenes is entirely indelible to Terry Gilliam as a filmmaker.
Abso-fucking-lutely.
Yeah.
And that is something I really connect with this film. This film is very much about Terry Gilliam talking about what it is to be kind of a broken down, tired old man who's having trouble getting his stories off the ground. You know, this is a movie he made after his tremendous, tremendous failure of Man of La Mancha. You know, a movie that was such a failure, they made a great documentary out of it. Like, it fucked up that bad that it makes a fascinating documentary, not an extra on a DVD, a whole fucking documentary, which if you have not seen, Lost in La Mancha. Oh my God, that is a documentary you need to sit down and watch.
They don't make movie. They don't make documentaries about movies that fail a little bit. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. And so this is kind of him cleansing that and telling the story and then having exactly the type of problems that Terry Gilliam has making his movies and telling his stories. And it is wonderful in that way, because this is so much what you love about Terry Gilliam. Like, it is weird, it is wacky, it is dark. There is a whole different story going on than what you think is going on the first time you watch through this movie. And then you just kind of get hit with the truth of it. And here, the truth of this movie is Terry Gilliam. Now we've got to talk about the downside to this movie, which is also in some regards the upside, as we mentioned earlier.
The visuals?
The actual imagination.
Yeah, and on the one hand, it is Gilliam to the nth degree. Gilliam, if you've ever seen the interstitials of a Monty Python's Flying Circus episode, those weird little cartoons, imagine that come to life. The best way I can think to describe the aesthetic of Terry Gilliam and his very imaginative style is, imagine Salvador Dali with a really complicated narrative behind it. Because it is a very absurd, very wild imagery that you're seeing, but all in service of a very, I mean, it's not just a one-off thing. It's all very in service to a very complicated narrative.
But imagine all of that without the money that your imagination is going for.
And there are so many shots that are beautiful and work, you know, with that style. And then there are so many things
like the first one when he gets launched into space and you have the space jellyfish and and you've got this weird thing on his shoulder, talking to him.
Oh, that's so perfect to encapsulate this movie, is because the jellyfish, the space, all of that works. The monster on the shoulder does not. So it's like this was made at a time when, I mean, like, it's not that we didn't understand CG. I mean, it was 2009. So, but it's still at that area where CG could be done very, very wrong.
Yes, like, it was still where cheap CG looked really
exactly,
cheap.
Exactly.
Whereas nowadays you can literally, like, you know, we have a guy who has a movie coming out in a few weeks that literally did all the special effects on his special effects movie on his own laptop over 18 months. The guy who made Rogue One, that's how he got to start with monsters. He literally shot a movie on a camera with two actors and a run and gun crew of like five guys, and then spent 18 months on a laptop doing his own visuals.
And my God, Monster looks good.
It looks good. And a few years, like a year or two or three later, or earlier, you have The Imaginary of Dr. Parnassus by Terry Gilliam, where you have these great scenes of all these, you know, like when you first go into the mirror and you're in the forest.
Yeah.
That is so amazingly Terry Gilliam. And then the CG sets in and you're like, this is interesting. And then you're like, this is a Windows screensaver.
The seams are visible from space. I know, because I was just there with some jellyfish.
Yep. And and it's very, very strange. But again, you mentioned the Dolly. Like, some of these visuals are so fucking amazing in concept. Like, you know, they're on the gondola, in the water, in a river, and then the river starts coiling up and turning into a snake, and it's a cobra head of Tom Waits. Like, the river has turned into a Tom Waits snake. How is that not fucking amazing? And because it looks like it cost $12 in this day and age.
But one of the visuals that I really will never be able to get is the balloon, the multi-faced balloon.
Oh, yes.
And that looks amazing. And I wanted the whole movie to look like that. And when you first sweep into all the vistas, they look amazing. Like, all of the locations that they create digitally look amazing. But when things start moving, or when it's growing pain is essentially what it is. When that scenery starts to shift and move and try to, I mean, it is the epitome of the reach out, exceeding the grasp. Because it's reaching.
The reach around exceeding the grass?
Yes, the reach around exceeding the grass. Because that scenery is reaching around, and every time it does, things get a little messy.
There it is. You know what? It's Gilliam. So, I mean, there's plenty of that. There's plenty of that subtlety in this movie.
Yeah.
As is.
Boy, plenty of our dirty talk subtlety? Because I don't feel like that was that subtle.
It's not that subtle. yeah, it's really, really not. But yeah, so so that is the movie's one major downfall. Is some of those scenes just don't look great, and some of them do. Like, yeah. That's the thing, is like that balloon is fucking amazing.
Yeah,
and there's some great moments, and then there's other moments that just aren't. But at the same time, all of those scenes have great metaphorical importance and all do something. There's never any scene where you're just supposed to be sitting there going, ooh, ah, I am awed by these visuals that I've never seen before. It is all in service of a greater story, and everything has, everything means something.
Yeah.
So no matter how subtle, and it's really, it's especially like when you see the scene where they're starting to get the rich women and taking them in. And
one of them, by the way, played by Gwendolyn Christie from Game of Thrones, her first screen credit. She plays Brienne of Tarth, for those of you who don't know.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't really recognize her.
Nope.
That sure is her. And it's that sequence in particular is really great. That's the sequence where you really wrap your head around who he is, who Parnassus is as Felicity, like what his purpose is. Like, he really is giving these women what they want, giving them the happiness, giving them the realization, making them happy with who they are by exposing them to what it is that makes them happy and letting them embrace that.
Yeah.
And then at the moment, you know, and that's what's so interesting is watching Tony in those scenes, because Tony very much becomes, you know, arguing against the devil. And you realize that that's the real thematic thing for his arc, is that he's a guy who's constantly able to talk people out of going with the devil and thinking that he's on the side of righteousness, even though he's self-serving the whole time.
Which is what's so ironic about the fact that he's wearing a white suit. He is the white knight of the movie, but not really.
Yes.
Yeah.
He is not actually, like, he really is the whole reason the devil's there.
Yeah.
The devil is there to get this motherfucker, but he knows that Parnassus, you can't just ask Parnassus to do something.
Yeah.
You have to make a bet with him, because Parnassus, his happiness is in winning a bet.
Yeah.
And he loves the winning of the bet. And that is his moment. And much like many of the people that he fails, he is a broken down person who keeps falling and choosing the devil time and again. But that's part of his cycle, because he has to. Like, he has to actually do battle with the devil this way so that the devil can get his souls. And I find that dichotomy fascinating. Like, I just love that whole aspect of storytelling, where we're led down this primrose path, that he is just this guy that has made the wrong bet with the devil, and he doesn't even know who he is. He doesn't know the purpose he serves in the universe. He has told stories time and time again, so much so that he believes his own story. And that he doesn't realize, like, that's one of the things I absolutely love, is that the devil doesn't actually want this girl. Like, the whole time he's acting like he can't wait for this girl to be 16, but he's giving Parnassus every chance he doesn't actually want to take this girl.
And this is what I love about Gilliam, is the number of different influences and the number of relatable texts that he's borrowing from, and this nexus point where they all come together. I mean, he's borrowing from a very Old Testament Bible, where, you know, God would routinely fuck with his own followers to prove points to the devil.
Yeah.
But then he's also borrowing from Greek mythology. I mean, both in the actual appearance and set dressing of the show, and the fact that there's a little bit of the Persephone myth in here, and there's a lot of, a lot of the classic tragic Greek heroes. So, I mean, there are all of these different wells that he's drawing from, and creating something very much uniquely Gilliam at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's what's so fascinating to watch, just from an aesthetic level. And then, as Cargill was talking about, the highly complex nature of you can't even really call this a good and evil struggle, because
good and evil are working together against a shitheel.
Yeah.
Like, the devil at the end of the day is getting the guy who should have gotten, like, he's our vengeance. Like, he's our revenge. Like, but the devil doesn't get anyone innocent in this movie, nor does he try to.
Yeah.
Like, every time he loses, he shrugs.
Yeah.
He's just like, oh man, maybe I'll get him next time. Like, he actually loves getting the people who are awful, but everyone the devil actually gets has it coming.
Yeah. The Dexter Devil, as we mentioned before.
Yeah, he's the Dexter Devil, and he's played by Tom Waits.
So good.
How fucking cool is that?
So good.
So, yeah, no, I absolutely adore this movie. And, oh, God, every performance in this film, everyone, I hesitate. I beseech you to find a better Vern Troyer performance than here. Like, the thing is, you know, as Mini-Me, he's really hilarious, but it's the gag that he's small.
Yeah.
Here, that's like every time it's brought up, either he's the one joking about it or it's somebody being really offensive to the point that where you're not laughing at Vern Troyer, you're like narrowing your eyes with Vern Troyer. Like the moment, there's one moment though, I will mention that doesn't translate to 2016.
Okay.
The moment Vern Troyer's in blackface.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, where it's supposed to be like avant-garde offensive, but in doing so, it just becomes kind of offensive, where it's like, oh, okay, I get in Europe that's not as offensive as we find it over here, but at the time it was like, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, Terry Gilliam is doing that. And now in 2016, it's like, oh, God, I really wish Terry Gilliam hadn't done that.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's just move along. This scene is inappropriate. And the other thing, the rest of the scene works.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And the other thing I love about Vern Troyer is he's got some really just on-point pieces of dialogue. Like, oh, one God. Of my favorite lines in the movie is when Tony wakes up from being rescued from, you know, essentially hanging, and he says, "Where the hell are we?" And Vern Troyer's response is just so good. He says,
That's one of the three answers.
Yes.
Like, it's one of the three answers. It's like,
geographically speaking, in the Northern Hemisphere, socially on the margins, and narratively with some way to go.
Yeah. And he's literally talking about, where we are in the story, we're still at the beginning. Because he's being honest to the audience. That's one of the three answers. And that is, he's such a great character for this. Like, he is Claude Rains in this to a certain degree. Like, he is Parnassus's number one guy, and Parnassus's big success at the end is, despite the fact that Vern Troyer should have left, he's still there because he's not going away. Like, these are two guys who are together forever. He is, you know, he is his archangel. He is the guy that is there to help facilitate the facilitator.
Exactly.
And I love that. And I love how subtle this entire movie is. Yeah. Like, it really is a movie that, again, like many of Gilliam's films, invites you to dissect it, to take it apart, see what Gilliam's actually saying, see what's really going on in the story, and just kind of revel in that. And I just love it. I love the story that Gilliam wanted to tell us here and share with us about his own feelings on his dealings with the devil.
Yeah. And to bring this full circle and to really hit the nail on the head of how good a movie this is a movie with one of the most tragic behind-the-scenes stories of any film, and we spent the majority of this show not talking about that behind-the-scenes story, but rather talking about the narrative and the journey of the film itself, of the story within the film. So that, I feel like, I can't say it enough, is such a testament to how good this movie really is.
Nothing's permanent, not even death.
And to bring it around to a junk food pairing, I went with Devil's Food Cake for a couple of reasons. One, as we mentioned before, Tom Waits, one of the many actors to play the devil himself, and doing so remarkably well. So there's a tie-in.
And maybe he's really, like, watching it again, I kind of think he's tied for my favorite with Max von Sydow.
I feel like patrons, I feel like there's a top five list in our future of top five cinematic devils. But the other thing about Devil's Food is it's made with a different type of chocolate. It's a dense, rich chocolate, and it's traditionally used as unsweetened chocolate baking squares in lieu of unsweetened cocoa powder. And what that produces is a more bittersweet taste. And I feel like if there is one word to describe watching this film today, and especially if you pair it with something like The Dark Knight or any other of Heath Ledger's outstanding performances, is it is bittersweet. That's entirely what this is. When you see Heath Ledger for the first time in this movie and he's hanging from a bridge and you just remember the tragedy of such a talented person gone too soon, but then you exult in how great of a performance he turns in as his final goodbye, as his curtain call, bittersweet's the word I would use to describe that.
Yeah. I would, if I might add to that, I would also add in a fifth of whiskey and three packs of unfiltered cigarettes.
Yeah.
Because you got to go full Tom Waits.
I feel like you do have to go full Tom Waits. I like that.
I have a friend that saw Tom Waits once and told me the story about what it was like to see Tom Waits. And I'm like, oh my God, what was the show like? And it's like, well, we sat around for 2 hours and he didn't show up. And we were literally just standing there and people were starting to get angry and cantankerous. And there was this guy passed out on the bar the whole time. And then at some point, the bartender was like tapping him on the shoulder to tell him to go. And he goes, oh, all right. And he staggers up to stage and it's Tom Waits.
Holy shit.
And Tom Waits then performs and is fucking amazing. And everybody was suddenly cool with it because they had literally been walking, stepping over and walking around a drunken Tom Waits for 2 hours, getting angry. And then he put on a great show. I don't know how true that story is, but it's a story that I want to believe is true.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the audience he was a no-show at his own concert. That's going to do it for this week's episode. I hope you have enjoyed it. If you would like to hear more of our episodes, check out the back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. I would like to believe that if you go there, you will discover some things that you'll like. I like to believe that we're a podcast that is geographically speaking in the Northern Hemisphere, socially on the margins, and narratively with some way to go. And we will have much more to go if you go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and become a patron to help us keep the lights on here at Junk Food Cinema. We will kick you some bonus content that is our way of rewarding you for supporting us. And Cargill, where can people find you online?
Well, you can find me at twitter.com, at MassaWyrm, MassaWyrm, or on Facebook, facebook.com/MassaWyrm.
Awesome. I'm at Bryguy Salisbury on Twitter. You can also follow this show on Twitter, at Junk Food Cinema, and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. But, Doctor. That's a wrap on this edition of Mr. Doctor, the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. And before we go, I would just like to remind you, don't believe everything you read, especially the mirror.